Welcome to the Reasonable Faith Podcast with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, privileged to be in studio with Dr. Craig. Bill, we always get questions on the Kalam cosmological argument, an infinite number of questions on the Kalam cosmological argument. And it just goes to show how fascinating this is. And I want to read this one letter that we got. It says, "Dear Dr. Craig, while an atheist, I do admire the intellectual rigor which you apply to your beliefs. It is refreshing to see someone defend their faith with such intelligence. My question is concerning whether the Kalam commits the fallacy of composition. That is, assuming something whole has the same properties as its parts. For example, the alphabet is made up of letters, but is not itself a letter." So, Bill, why don't you discuss the fallacy of composition first?
The fallacy of composition, as he says, is reasoning that because all of the parts of something have a certain property, therefore the whole has that property. For example, if every little piece of an elephant is light in weight, then the whole elephant is light in weight. That would be committing the fallacy of composition. It's not true that because every part has a property, that the whole thing composed of those parts has the property. And I think, Kevin, the allegation here is supposed to be against the premise that says everything that begins to exist has a cause. And the reader apparently is under the impression that one justifies seeking a cause of the universe by arguing compositionally, that because everything in the universe has a cause, therefore the universe as a whole has a cause. And that's just manifestly incorrect. That is the fallacy of composition. But if you read my work, I think you'll find nowhere in anything that I've ever written or published or said have I defended the causal principle or there being a cause of the universe by composition. That would be obviously fallacious. Rather, what I argue is that the principle, everything that begins to exist, everything that comes into being at some point, must have a cause which brings it into existence. And this is rooted in the metaphysical truth that something can't come out of nothing. And moreover, I think that this principle is constantly confirmed in our experience. So I wouldn't think to try to justify the Kalam cosmological argument's conclusion by arguing from composition. That would just be wrong, but he's setting up a straw man here, which no one has defended.
What if I were to say that all the tiles on the floor are brown, therefore the floor is brown?
Yes, what that illustrates is that sometimes the whole does possess the property of its parts, and if every piece of the floor is brown, then the whole floor is brown. That seems obviously true. So sometimes the whole will have the property of its parts, other times it won't, and therefore you can't just automatically assume that because every piece or part of a whole has a property, therefore the whole has it. It may indeed have it, but you can't reason that just because the part has it, therefore the whole has it. You would have to give some sort of justification for thinking that the whole would have the property that its parts do.
This says, "Hello, Dr. Craig. I, like you, believe that God exists. However, I'm a bit skeptical on the merits of your arguments against infinite successions." In fact, Gale and Pruss encapsulated some of my suspicions within some of their most recent work. And he quotes their work. Quote, "These arguments against an actual infinity, however, are all based on a confusion between two notions of bigger than. One notion is numerical. A set is bigger than another if it has a greater number of members. The other notion is in terms of part-to-whole relations. A whole is bigger than any proper part. When dealing with finite quantities, anything that is bigger in the part-to-whole sense is also bigger in the numerical sense. But this is not so in the case of infinite quantities. Although in the part-to-whole sense there are more people in the hotel after a new guest arrives, and there are more members of the original series of events, in the numerical sense there are not. Indeed, mathematicians take the failure of the part-to-whole sense of bigger than to imply the numerical sense to be the defining feature of infinity." Now, I know some people's eyes glazed over on that, but he is quoting from the Oxford Handbook of Philosophy of Religion. Break this objection down for us.
Well, the idea here is that when you ask how many people are in the infinite hotel, the answer numerically is there are an infinite number of people. Now, if more people check into the hotel, additional people, numerically, there aren't any more people in the hotel because infinity plus any natural number is infinity. So there aren't any more people. But in the what he calls the part-whole sense, there are more people in the hotel because there was the group that was already in it, and then there's the group that now has checked into the hotel, and this new group is not a part of this larger group that was already there. So in one sense, there are additional people in the hotel, not in a numerical sense, but in the sense that the whole group of people in the hotel now has persons in it that weren't there before. Now, far from eliminating the absurdity of the existence of an actual infinite, I think all this does is to elucidate it. It explains what the problem is, namely that this part whole and numerical sense of more fall apart for infinite quantities. And you get these sort of absurdities where you have, in one sense, more people into the hotel, but in another sense, there aren't any more people in the hotel. And I find that to be simply incredible. It seems to me that that is why the actual infinite cannot exist, is because it involves this very peculiar feature. But not all of the paradoxes or the puzzles about actual infinity are based simply upon this falling apart of part whole and numerical sizes. For example, when the people check out of the hotel and you start subtracting infinite quantities from infinite quantities, mathematically you end up with self-contradictory answers. And there, I don't think there's any escape from the argument in this sort of thing, because what you have to say is you subtract identical quantities from identical quantities, and you wind up with identical quantities. And that seems to me, again, to be absurd. So while his analysis of the situation is correct, I just don't see that it does anything to alleviate the absurdity of the real existence of an actually infinite number of things.
Dear Dr. Craig, thank you for your work. And this questioner says, I am reading Victor Stinger's book. You've debated him a couple of times. I'm reading his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis. And in the fourth chapter, titled Cosmic Evidence, he makes somewhat of a response to your cosmological argument. Would you please address? On page 122, he says, Christian apologist William Lane Craig has made a number of sophisticated arguments that he claims show that the universe must have had a beginning, and that beginning implies a personal creator. Then he mentions you're using Hawking in support of this. He then continues, however, Hawking has repudiated his own earlier proof. In his bestseller, A Brief History of Time, he avers, there was, in fact, no singularity at the beginning of the universe. How do you respond to this?
What I would say is that Vic Stinger has put a spin here on Hawking's work that is very misleading. Hawking did not repudiate his earlier proof. He's talking there about the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems, which show that under very generalized conditions, the general theory of relativity predicts that the past cannot be infinite, but must terminate in a singularity, a point of infinite space-time curvature and density in the past. Now, what Hawking did after that in 1983 was develop a model of the universe based on the marriage of quantum physics with general relativity that enabled him to escape the conditions that predicted a singularity. So it wasn't that he repudiated the proof. The proof still holds for the singularity theorems, but what he was able to do was to craft a model that was an exception to the conditions that would predict a singularity, and he arrived at a universe that has a kind of rounded-off beginning, rather like a badminton birdie, where it doesn't go back to a point, but the initial part of the universe is rounded off. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Hawking was able to achieve this result only by using imaginary numbers for the time variable. Now, imaginary numbers are numbers which are the products of the square root of negative 1. Now, there's no real number that is the square root of a negative number, because any number squared is always a positive number. So mathematicians call these imaginary numbers. And the problem is that although these are useful tools in computations, nobody has any idea what it would mean to talk about imaginary time, any more than talking about the imaginary volume of this room or the imaginary area of a field. The use of imaginary numbers is just a mathematical device to make the equations easier to solve. But to get physically significant results, the physicists always convert back to real numbers at the end. And what Hawking admits is that when you reconvert to real numbers in his model, presto, the singularity reappears. The singularity is really there all the time. It's just concealed behind this mathematical artifice of imaginary time, which has no physical significance. But even if we do give physical significance to the Hartle-Hawking model, the overriding point that remains, and that Stenger doesn't appreciate, is that the model still begins to exist. It isn't infinitely extended in the past. It still has a beginning. It still comes into existence in the same way that the classical models did. It just doesn't do so at a point of infinite space-time curvature and infinite density. So Hawking himself says in his 1996 book, The Nature of Space and Time, co-authored with Roger Penrose, that virtually everyone today agrees that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. And his quantum physical model does nothing to extend the universe into the infinite past and to remove the beginning of the universe.
Dr. Craig, I've noticed that some of these questions that have come in kind of ask the same thing. I'm holding several in my hand here that ask, well, you know, how do we know that this is the only universe, that there weren't other universes prior to this one? Is such an assumption justified? Are we in any kind of epistemic position to know or justifiably believe that there is no other material or temporal object that exists outside our universe?
Mm-hmm. This is a much discussed question in the field of cosmology. There are theories called multiverse theories, which would suggest that our universe is just a tiny fraction of a much wider space-time reality. And the arguments that I give in the Kalam cosmological argument for the second premise that the universe began to exist is fully in conversation with these sorts of theories. On the one hand, there are the philosophical arguments against the possibility of an infinite regress. And those philosophical arguments, being metaphysical in nature, are not limited to this universe. It would apply to any wider sort of reality that this universe might be encompassed by, and would show that there cannot be an infinite regress of events, that you have to get back to an absolutely first cause, an uncaused cause of the universe. So the philosophical arguments are not in any way affected by the speculation that there might be a multiverse of which our universe is a part. Now, to address the question on a purely scientific level, the difficulty here is not only that there's no evidence for the existence of such wider parallel universes or encompassing mother universes, but rather that we have good reasons to think that such a multiverse does not exist, or at least cannot be extended into the infinite past. And I'm referring here to the 2003 theorem that was developed by Arvind Bord, Alexander Vilenkin, and Alan Guth. The Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem proves that any universe which is in a state of cosmic expansion, on average throughout its history, cannot be extended infinitely into the past, but must have a past absolute beginning. And their theorem applies to the multiverse as well, so that even if there is a multiverse of which our universe is a tiny part, it cannot be extended to the infinite past, but must have a beginning. And in our most recent work, published, for example, in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, Jim Sinclair and I go into this in some detail, looking at current speculations trying to avoid the Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem and whether or not these are plausible. And the fact is that there just is no scientifically credible or tenable model that can be extended into the infinite past. Any tenable model has a beginning to its existence, including these multiverse scenarios. So I think that insofar as you go with mainstream science, we're very justified, even just scientifically, not to speak of philosophically, in saying that the universe began to exist.
This questioner says, "Hello, Dr. Craig. My professor has presented these two refutations of the Kalam cosmological argument. Number one, he says that it begs the question. The first reason the Kalam argument is invalid and refuted is that it creates the logical fallacy of begging the question. This is because the phrase, whatever begins to exist, is not presumed to accommodate anything other than God, and that puts God into the definition of the premise of the argument that is supposed to prove his existence in the first place." Did you get that?
No, that is very strange. I'm troubled that a professor would say something that incoherent. What I have heard, Kevin, is people on the internet say, is that the premise, everything that begins to exist has a cause, begs the question because it assumes that the universe has a cause. And that's supposed to be the conclusion of the argument. Now, what these folks have failed to understand is the difference between begging the question and a deductive argument. A deductive argument, by its very nature, is simply an unpacking of what is already implicit in the premises. But that doesn't mean that it's question begging. For example, if I say, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, I'm not begging the question in asserting the first premise. That's just the nature of a deductive argument, that the premise is implicit, that the conclusion is implicit in the premises and is derived from it then by logical rules of inference. Begging the question means that your only reason for adopting a premise is that you already believe the conclusion. That's what it means to reason in a circle or beg the question. And that's not why, for example, you would believe all men are mortal. That would be based upon medical evidence and biological evidence about the human body and so forth. It's not begging the question. Similarly, the argument for everything beginning to exist having a cause would be based upon this metaphysical position that something cannot come out of nothing, that things don't just pop into being without having causes. So it's not because you believe the conclusion that you believe the premise. It's not begging the question in that circular way. Rather, it's simply the nature of a deductive argument that the conclusion is implicit in the premises and needs to be made explicit by the logical rules of inference.
The second objection this professor makes, he says, is the final and most powerful reason why the KCA is invalid and refuted can be expressed in a competing syllogism. One, everything that has sentience has a cause. Two, the Judeo-Christian God is said to have sentience. Three, therefore the Judeo-Christian God has a cause.
Now, that isn't an invalid argument. He hasn't shown it to be invalid. That's a logically valid argument. The problem is that his first premise is just false. Yeah. It's not true that everything that has sentience has a cause. I would say that God has no cause. God is sentient. So I would simply say the first premise is false. So he's at liberty to say that there are things that begin to exist without a cause. If he wants to, he can make that assertion. But then he's not disputing the validity of the argument. He's denying the truth of one of the premises. And I just don't see any good reason to deny the truth of the first premise, that everything that begins to exist has a cause. It seems to me that that premise is very plausibly true.
All right, very good. Thank you, Dr. Craig. Hey, be sure and come back. We're adding at least one new podcast per week here at reasonablefaith.org. So come be a part of us. Remember that you can partner with us financially when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Just click on the donate button and check out all the resources there as well. And we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.